mentioned being we have a plethora of foundational physicists in the building, but that doesn't mean that there's any possibility that our sound equipment will be solved in the near future. So
maybe it's the Pauli effect.
Yeah. I also wanted to comment to you. An essential aspect of this afternoon's festivities, which is the bantering part of Bistro Banter. So I encourage all our panelists to speak, and very well done, young Rod. don't wait to be spoken to before you speak. It's an informal session. I will begin with asking our panelists some specific questions, and they will have to do with not only the talks that they so eloquently gave today, but also their thoughts, their feelings, in keeping with this, the last weekend, the legacy weekend. This weekend, I remind you, is the weekend which concerns itself with Einstein's impact and his legacy, both science that is being done currently and science that we hope will be done or accomplished in the future. And I can think of no better people around me than these three gentlemen to be able to give their best judgment as to what might happen in the future. So let me begin with you, John.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that in your talk that Einstein was inspired, or certainly was potentially inspired, as a member of the Olympia Academy by Humboldt's unity of all natural phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And Einstein was well known as somebody who was driven consistently throughout his life by this desire to unify forces. Now, this is not, of course, uncommon at all among theoretical physicists, but...
Well, you use the word forces, but not necessarily so.
Okay.
In fact, what he did to gravity was showed it was not a force.
So you're being picky, which is a fine part of the bantering experience. So let me say unifying...
I always like the hand that feeds me.
Fine. That's good. So unifying... unifying physical phenomenon, if you will, or unifying on a conceptual level.
Good.
Thank you. Let me ask you, in your judgment, first of all, this is something that theoretical physicists often seem to take for granted as something to do or as the natural evolution of physics. Is that justified? I mean, is that no?
If you look at the history, you see as much disunification and branching out of new topics as you do unification. So it's more a philosophical idea. And I guess you take the same point of view as, was it Marat in the French Revolution? En s'engage et puis en voit. You start out and try to do it and see what happens. If it works, fine. If it doesn't, you draw the lesson from it.
Well, so Gary, let me turn to you. I mean, this is clearly an aspect of superstring theory, the motivations to unify and so forth. There are people who have accused physicists, both in the physics community and outside, of an undue propensity for unification, that there's this... That perhaps it's, as John said, just a philosophical view. It certainly was Einstein's view. Is there, what is your particular view on this notion of unifying phenomenon, unifying concepts?
Well, I agree with John that as we learn more and our understanding of physics increases, we tend to specialize in more and more subfields of physics, and that tends to give the impression of this disunification or something, of more and more specialties and subfields. But I think at a more fundamental level, you know, we're trying to unify things because that's somehow the simplest or most elegant way of describing nature. And I think most physicists share my view that if you have two competing explanations and they're both equally well, you know, in agreement with the data, you prefer the simplest. You prefer the one that, you know, is the most unified, the most elegant. And so that's, I think, why we're driven that way. It's for a sense of elegance.
Well, kind of give an example of what I mean.
Okay.
It would have been very elegant if one could have taken the existing machine of quantum field theory and used it to quantize general relativity. And one tried to do this for about 50 years.
Yeah.
But just as nothing succeeds like success, nothing fails like failure. And the failure of all these attempts has shown that one cannot do this, and that this attempted unification, which would have been very beautiful and elegant, doesn't work. So we have to try something new. And there's a lot of divergence about what quantum gravity means, really. It's really a name for X, the unknown. And so this is a case where an attempted unification failed.
Well, it was unifying maybe at the wrong level. I mean, you're saying that we took our theories as we understood it, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, and we said, okay, we understand quantum mechanics in this way in terms of quantum field theory, and we understand general relativity. Let's just try sort of the most straightforward brute force way to put them together. And you're right, it failed. But that, you know, to many of us just means, well, we're not looking at the sort of, you know, the right level.
What I'm saying is we can learn as much from a failure of a unification as we can from a success. Maybe
okay,
different things.
Sure. Yeah, so imposing at least my right arm, if nothing else. Arthur, do you have any views on this notion of the physicist's tendency to unify notions, unify concepts, whether it's been necessary, whether certainly it's been fruitful to some extent, whether it's just a philosophical preoccupation that people might want to dispense with or not?
Well, I personally believe that's the way to go because I'm sure that is a set of rules out there. That set of rules doesn't matter about the knowledge or lack of knowledge about the thing. In other words, it's only if there's a set of rules that was there, but it was just, it happened to be just designed by not that that's only nature doesn't know about our regimental thinking about nature, but you know, we try to understand from this angle, from another angle, yet from another angle. Surely there is a one set of rules there, and maybe I'm sure that there's a sort of a philosophical belief that there is a set of rules for us to discover, but I certainly believe there is, and nature doesn't know anything about us trying to divide it into electromagnetic, weak interactions, strong gravity, and our struggle to come up with a good distinction. So I think it is out there, and it's only natural for us to go into it.
Sure, but it could be, it could well be the sense. I mean, if you go back to before wandering so long, right, you could have a situation where these guys would have said, yes, this is a symmetry of nature, and here's the evidence that it indicates symmetry breaking, and this is where you should look for the W and Z, and people wouldn't have found it. And they would have been able to say, well, no, I'm sorry, they just aren't. And there's somebody who's desperate to say something. I will call upon the esteemed gentleman to my left to add some point.
Yes, I understand. I've heard a lot about failure theories, philosophy theories. And about the best practices examples of what we mean by failure. I mean, was it something plain where they're divided by zero?
So let me pick up on that question and fold it into the so and Gary, you mentioned this. So in the 1920s, Kaluza and Klein had a framework by which they unified electromagnetism and gravity, although they had
by the way, they were not the first to do the five dimensions.
Fine, you'll get your papers. Hold on, I'm in the middle of a sentence. So but they had to go to 5D to be able to do it, 5 dimensions to be able to do it. So this this calls up, I think, an aspect of your point as well as an additional question, which is Einstein, I've never heard any comments about what Einstein thought about all this, and he was clearly alive at the time. He was looking for unification. Clearly, in his view, I would imagine he would have heard of this and he would have considered this insufficient because you did have to go to 5 dimensions to do it. That's what I would surmise. What were his views with Kaluza-Klein and what were his concerns with that? And then relatedly, I'm going to ask what his views of extra dimensions are in general. But John, why don't you
he
start
was very pragmatic. He
anyway.
Tried everything.
Right.
He tried the five-dimensional approaches. He tried non-symmetric connections, non-symmetric metrics. He tried something equivalent to spinners. He tried all sorts of things. And the point is either the unification was trivial in the sense that nothing new came out of it, like the Kaluza-Klein presented a new point of view, but it led to no new predictions precisely because it incorporated Maxwell's theory just unchanged into the relativity framework. But I did want to point out that the first one to do the five-dimensional formulation was Nordstrom, who had a scalar theory of gravitation, which he presented, and Einstein considered the only serious rival to his tensor theory. Nordstrom presented this around 1912, 1913. And he showed that that could be unified with electromagnetism on a five-dimensional basis. There was really nothing special about general relativity. As Holly points out in this encyclopedia article, any gauge invariant theory can be united with gravitation in the five-dimensional formulation.
Yeah, can I comment on that?
Please.
I think it should be kept in mind that at this point, when they were discussing it in the 1920s, this was a unification of classical forces.
Sure.
There was the electromagnetic force, there was gravity, they were trying to put it together in a way, you know, it was just consistent with classical physics. And it certainly doesn't help when you include quantum mechanics.
Sure.
You ask what goes wrong if you try to just sort of straightforwardly do it, and what you find is that you just keep getting infinity. Every time you calculate something, it's infinite. And that's the sort of thing that goes wrong if you don't have the right framework. And when you do it in five dimensions, you just get more infinities. Okay, so the problem gets worse if you try to do it in the straightforward way, just going to higher dimensions.
Good. Arthur, did you want to?
Well, I was thinking about the question you asked me, and I was just thinking, well, what do I think really about unification? And I just realized that there is an interesting thing that happened in this field of quantum information science. Namely, we started to think about other areas. Oh, does it work now?
Oh, it does. Wow. Well. Testing, yes. So what happened was that we started looking into computer science, for example, and think about it more and more as physics. So you think, okay, computer, your input is your computer is a physical system. Input is your initial state, and output is the final state. And you start analyzing computation not in terms of abstract mathematical symbols, but in terms of real physical process. So somehow, physics becomes more Catholic, I mean, all-embracing. I don't want to use those religious terms. I once used these terms in Northern Ireland, and I got myself into all kind of trouble. And you know, personally, I have this ongoing discussion with Michele Mosca, who is here, who always defines himself as mathematician proper. And when he came to Oxford to do PhD with me, he didn't want to have his degree in physics, so he insisted that it's going to be in mathematics. I said, well, Mike, why do you care? You know, at the end of the day, mathematics is physics, and it's sort of like a...
could I ask a question?
You just have.
You didn't answer? Anyway, it's directed to Gary. To succeed in formulating special theory, the general theory of relativity, Einstein had to unlearn a lesson which he had learned so well for the special theory. In the special theory, he says in the paper, you have to attach physical meaning to the coordinates. You have to attach it to some physical reference frame in order to give meaning to the components of the electromagnetic field in order to give to get out of the problems of electrodynamics at that time. To succeed in formulating general relativity, you have to unlearn that lesson and learn that the coordinates mean nothing. The difference being that in special relativity, there's a fixed background space-time structure. He didn't know it at that time, but it's what we now call the Minkowski space-time structure. Whereas general relativity is a background independent theory. Everything is dynamical in general relativity, including the space-time structure itself. And so this forces one to a relational point of view about physics, that the fields are just, space-time is just an aspect, a structural aspect of the field, not to be given any independent character. And the big problem in quantum gravity, then, is how do you unite this, how to bring together this feature of general relativity, background independence, with the fact that all existing quantum theories are background dependent. They depend on having some fixed background space-time structure, not only for the formulation of the theory, but for the physical interpretation of it, in terms of where you make measurements, how do you place an apparatus, when you turn it on, and so forth. It's assumed you know what the space-time structure is. Now, the approach to this problem leads you to two points of view. The people who come from the quantum field theory side say, keep the background space-time structure, increase the number of dimensions if you like, 9, 10, 11, whatever you like, and somehow incorporate general relativity. And that's what the string theory people do at this point. Whereas general relativists, people come with a general relativity background like myself, say the problem is to develop a background-independent formulation of quantum theory. And that's what people who work on loop quantum gravity are trying to do. Now, I'm not ruling out string theory by saying this, because there are people in the string theory community, like Brian Greene, who say that what we have to do is develop a background-independent formulation of string theory. And I have a nice long quote here from Brian, which I won't read, But he ends up saying, many researchers consider the development of a background-independent formulation to be the single greatest unresolved problem facing string theory. Gary, are you one of those?
I do think before Gary responds, we should give him half an hour to prepare his PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah, I feel a little... I feel a little set up here with a question so well prepared. But I will say that I think string theory has progressed. Everyone, I would say, in string theory agrees that we need a background independent formulation of the theory. So it's not just Brian Greene, and it's not a small subset. And until about 1995, it was a serious problem in that our understanding of string theory was heavily based on having a fixed background metric, as Professor Satchel was just saying, and basically what we knew how to do was to talk about fields on that background, or rather strings, I should say, moving on that background and how they interacted with each other. But since 1997, there's been significant progress in constructing a background-independent formulation, and I'd say that we now have a background-independent formulation for some cases, and what I mean by that is that for certain boundary conditions sort of at infinity, if you put on some conditions on how things have to behave at very large distances, sort of in the asymptotic region, you don't need to specify any sort of background, any sort of metric or space-time in the interior. And I think that's a tremendous advance. Everybody in string theory recognizes it as such. And it has really alleviated a lot of the concern that some people had that, you know, string theory was necessarily tied to a fixed background. Now, of course, it's not the whole story, because we want to be able to talk about string theory for any sort of boundary conditions and not just the ones that allow us to do what we know how to do so far. But string theory is a theory which is still being developed. It's not, you know, fully understood or fully formulated. But I don't think the problem of not having, you know, or of having a background is a serious criticism or concern. It's something that we're working on, and we have in many cases removed that background.
That's an extremely good answer, especially given the amount of time you had to prepare it. But, of course, this is not the first time you've heard these accusations, so I guess. I do want to caution all of our panelists. No. I'm sure you do. I want to caution all of our panelists, however much I'm encouraging you to banter, I do want to make sure that this is held at a sufficiently general level, and we don't want to get into too many technical aspects and details of various theories of which people may have limited understanding or perhaps more relevantly, limited interest. Let me now move to the colleague to my left, Archer. In your very clear and informative and lucid description of quantum cryptography, you shied away at the last moment when somebody asked you a question which was leading towards your own personal views of interpretation of quantum theory, when you alluded to the fact that you have them, but you weren't going to tell people what they were. So now it seems to me to be a good opportunity for you to come clean and let us know what you think.
Well, I tell you a story, okay? Some time ago, I was attending a conference in Italy, in Arica, and I was discussing things with a friend of mine, a logician, Bob Solvay. And Bob has this very, very peculiar voice. I mean, it's really very characteristic. And it was a conference dinner. So, you know, there was this background noise of cutlery and everything. And at some point, Bob just lowered his voice and asked, and told me, Arthur, can I ask you a very personal question? You know, everyone went silent in the room at this moment. And then I said, well, sure, go ahead. He said, what is your favorite interpretation of quantum theory? So thank you, Howard. He just, well, okay, well, I like the Everett interpretation, so that would be my answer. I'm a reluctant believer in the Everett interpretation. Let me just explain, if you will. It is bizarre because it somehow assumes that there are many. It is also known under the name many world interpretation. So what I find interesting is that physicists are very much willing to accept the fact that a photon can exist in two different realities, so to speak, when it goes through an interferometer, through Hausdorff mirror. But when we scale up things, physicists are getting more and more reluctant to accept that the same physical phenomenon can actually also govern macroscopical objects. So somehow I don't have any better view on quantum mechanics apart from assuming that everything is quantum, that quantum theory is not just a piece of quantum embedded in classical reality. And I would like to see quantum theory as a universal theory. And taking this view, I'm gone in this direction when I quantize everything. And at the end of the day, I have to assume that I'm also quantized and can exist in those superpositions. And I do take the Everett view. I wish I could take some more reasonable view, but I cannot find any other.
So thank you for your candor. I should mention that earlier I mentioned that I believe it was David Merman divided the theoretical physics community into various different categories. There were people who were concerned about foundational issues of quantum theory, and then there was the majority who were not concerned. And then he made a further he differentiated further between those in the not concerned camp. And he said that there was one category of people who were not concerned and refused to tell why. And then there was another category of people who were not concerned and gave some specious and really fairly flimsy reason for why they were not concerned. And then recently there was a third category of people who were not concerned because they adamantly claimed that Niels Bohr figured everything out, but then when further pressed, they too would never explain why. Let me now.
Could I explain why?
Yes. I'm going to ask both John and, in the interest of time, Gary after that, what their particular issues with quantum theory are, whether in fact they think that there are any issues of interpretation, whether there's anything that bothers them, and if so, what it is and what their particular resolution might be.
You first. Okay. Thank you. Before going on, let me just remind you the anecdote from Oscar Wilde's Poets Being Earnest, where this question of other worlds comes up, and Ernest says, "This world is good enough for me." And the young lady replies, "Yes, but are you good enough for this world?" Perhaps that's the question you should be asking ourselves. But anyway, the point of view I take towards quantum mechanics is the Bohr point of view, or I might better say the Bohr-Feynman point of view, that quantum mechanics only deals with total phenomena, which involves a preparation, some sort of interaction, and then a registration, often called a measurement. But I think nothing anthropomorphic is implied by that. Just some irreversible recording is necessary, whether anybody ever looks at that result or not. But this point of view means you can't ask more of quantum mechanics than it can give you. It requires some sort of background. It can only deal with open systems. It requires some sort of background macroscopic, classically treated preparation and registration process and description of the interaction. You want more from that, then go beyond quantum mechanics, but don't ask of quantum mechanics more than it can give. When you try to give a realistic interpretation of the wave function, you really get into trouble. As we just heard the proponent of the point of view, many worlds point of view, saying he himself can't really feel comfortable with it. And I still remember one of my teachers, Dave Finkelstein, told me about having a wave function. He said, having a wave function is like having a haircut. If you're not careful, you start to wonder, where's my haircut? Well, I'm not having it. The wave function, from this point of view.
You see, some of us don't have to worry about this. I mean.
I still have some slight worries in this. But the point is that if you look upon the wave function just as a calculational device which helps you to calculate a probability amplitude for a process, you could calculate it other ways if you like, but often it's a useful way. But it's not something to be taken as realistic ontologically. It does not exist. The great mystery of quantum mechanics is when you try to calculate a probability amplitude per process, why do you have to add the amplitudes for the subprocesses if they're not distinguishable, whereas you have to add the probabilities if they are distinguishable? That is the single mystery of quantum mechanics, as Feynman pointed out, as I tried to indicate in a paper I wrote on this subject.
Gary.
So don't, no, my model is just don't ask more of quantum mechanics than it can give you, or you get into trouble.
Gary?
Okay, so when you said that physicists were divided up into those that worry about the foundations of quantum mechanics and those that don't, I guess I fall in the second category. I don't worry about it. But that's not because I'm totally comfortable with quantum mechanics. It's just that there's a finite amount of time in the day, and I would rather think about other things. So I spend my time thinking about string theory and trying to understand better what string theory has to say about quantum gravity and space and time. And so far, that has not required any sort of deep change hasn't also shed any light on the foundations of quantum mechanics. We're more or less using quantum mechanics the way physicists have used quantum mechanics for the past 80 years, and so far it's been working pretty well in string theory. So, I mean, for that reason, we haven't, or I haven't, spent much time thinking about the foundational issues.
So, I'm tempted to say, and since this is the last bistro banter, I guess I will say, I have enormous respect for you, sir, with all you've accomplished, but that strikes me as very much of an elegant cop-out to the question.
Could I sneak in under your radar and ask Gary a question?
I think you're over the radar.
You said that you have a background in independent formulation of string theory or M theory. Do you have a background independent quantization technique to use? That's the question.
Because I think, John, it's to ask him later. Okay, you can confront him later. I don't think this is appropriate for the format of this particular discussion. In fact, let me ask you a question. Sure. Getting back to your talk. So, for those of you who weren't here for John's talk, John was looking at the. Well, you're going to correct me, I'm sure. But the he was focusing on an aspect of Einstein's work which many people hadn't recognized or fully appreciated, and that is Einstein's misgivings or concerns about the continuum and this the two possibilities in terms of further progress between a more algebraic, discrete way of looking at space-time and assuming the continuum. And in your talk, I thought you did this very well. You were describing.
I'm sure you will.
I'm trying to keep you at bay by buttering you up. You see, this is my philosophy. So, as you went through your talk, you were giving evidence for Einstein's recognition of the potential problem with the continuum. And again, all the way through the Olympia Academy up until he finally went public, as it were, with this shortly before he died in the 50s, and his letter to Aaron Fest and so forth. And my question to you is, I guess, more a sociological one, which is, given that he had these concerns, and given that he read Dedekind and so forth from an early age, and given that he recognized this was always a possibility, even though he didn't know exactly how to proceed, as you said, why was it that he seemed to be so reluctant to be public in his concerns about this, and that he kept it so much to himself until the very end, if he really did consider this to be a potentially huge problem?
Well, if you examine my talk carefully, you see he did start to mention these problems in 1923, mentioned them again in 36.
Different letters, right?
No, published papers, yeah. So he did mention a couple of times, but the answer is always, I don't know what to do. He had no mathematical approach that enabled him to embody his conceptual ideas. And indeed, there's an interesting anecdote which Abraham Frankel, a mathematician, tells. When he went to visit Einstein towards the end of his life, Frankel developed non-standard analysis, and Einstein was extremely interested and wanted to know all the details. And Frankel, when he recounts the anecdote, doesn't understand why. At least doesn't tell us the reason why. I think I know why. Einstein thought some new mathematics, maybe this is going to be a way to get away from the continuum. It wasn't, but I think that was the reason why Einstein got so excited. He was always looking for some mathematical technique. But his point of view was, you don't publish something until you have a way of really making something serious out of it. I'll give you another example of that. He discovered the phenomenon of gravitational lensing in 1912, and we have a notebook of his to prove that. If you follow through the jotting down he put of his equations, you can see all the basic ideas, including some of the effects you would see with gravitational lensing. He didn't publish it. He only published it in 1936 when somebody else urged him to do it, and he did it very reluctantly. Why? He didn't think there was any possibility of experimentally verifying this. So he was not one who just published something to get it on the record. And I think, again, these ideas of his, since he had no way of embodying them in a concrete theory of what he called a purely algebraic physics, a combinatorial approach, he never published anything more than just the vaguest hints, even in his published papers. So it was Einstein's philosophy that you don't just publish for the sake of shooting off your mouth, which too many physicists and others do today.
Okay, good time to interrupt. So, thank you for that. Let me turn to you, Gary. In your talk, you alluded to, you made a very clear distinction between that which has been experimentally verified and that which has not, and is now currently in the realm of speculation. And you also alluded to, I think, as a response to a question, possibilities of what we might find at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, the Large Particle Accelerator, when it goes online in 2007 or shortly thereafter. Is it longer than that? I thought it was two. Anyway, whenever it goes online. So rather than ask you what we might see, when that happens, because that's a very, very long, that could be a very long answer, and there are lots of people who speculate all sorts of things, as you know far better than I. But let me ask you a personal question, since you so, so thoroughly evaded the question I asked you last time, which is, what do you think we will see when you turn, when we turn the LHC on?
A bean.
Well, what we will certainly see, I think, is something called the Higgs particle. Now, I don't want to be too technical, but this is sort of the one particle in what's called the standard model of particle physics, which has not yet been observed. It's been assumed, I think it was originally postulated by Higgs back in the early 60s. It's been incorporated in our standard model of particle physics. Everything that we calculate, assuming it exists, is in very good agreement with the data. So I think people would be extremely surprised if we don't see this Higgs or something very much like it at the LHC. That, unfortunately, won't tell us anything about string theory, because string theory is really talking about scales much farther away than what this Higgs and what the standard elementary particle theory deals with. But that's, I think, a pretty safe prediction. Now, the next thing that I, that's what I was getting at. The next thing that we might see, and I have sort of less confidence in this, but I'm still hopeful, is that we'll see evidence for something called supersymmetry. Now, supersymmetry is a new kind of symmetry, which was postulated, I guess, starting in the early 70s. It's a symmetry between, in some sense, between particles and forces. So it's a new kind of symmetry. And it, again, has been incorporated into theories. It is an important ingredient in string theory. We don't know for sure exactly at what point we will see evidence of supersymmetry, but there's a chance we'll see it at the LHC, and it would be tremendously exciting if we do, because not only is it, you know, evidence of this new structure about particles, in some sense, supersymmetry is a new kind of symmetry of space and time itself. And so this would really be telling us something new about space and time as well.
But just to recapitulate, you're sort of confident, so what's your percentage of confidence that we'll find super? I'm trying to pin you down here. If you had to put money on it, how much money would you put on super?
I'd give it, what would I bet? I guess I would say about 60-40 odds in favor of supersymmetry.
Good. Thank you.
What experiment could falsify supersymmetry?
Okay. Another question that we can have later. Address. Arthur, let me turn to you. So one of the things you alluded to, but again did not discuss very much in your talk, was quantum computers. You mentioned quantum computers and quantum computation with respect to a whole host of quantum-related technologies, but you didn't have the opportunity or the time to be addressing that. Let me ask you a specific question related to quantum computers along the same lines as that I just asked Gary, which is, will a quantum computer be built? And if so, what would your best guess be in terms of the timing of the development of a practical quantum computational device?
Well, the answer is yes, it will. Ray, in Waterloo, right? And which particular technology? Well, to be more serious, I mean, I didn't talk that much about quantum computing today. It's almost a separate topic for a lecture of an hour or two. But it is quite clear that those physical, that the feature size on in computers are smaller and smaller. So typical feature size on silicon today is of the order of microns, and we're going towards nanotechnology. We're going towards computing based on molecules and atoms. And once we're there, it seems that there's enormous power, and we have few ideas what to do with it. But of course, Howard's question is, can we really control nature at this level? And it seems that there's no reason why we couldn't. So it's if it's not impossible, therefore it must be possible. On this basis, I believe a quantum computer will be built.
And the timing.
Oh. He's really tough to me today. I should start asking him personal questions at some point. Well, I don't know. I would say that, of course, it's a very vague statement. What do you mean by a quantum computer? Like, a quantum repeater will probably appear within a decade. And a full-fledged quantum device, I would say 30, 40, 50 years. And which particular technology? This is your next question, right? Yes. I at the moment, I would bet probably on something like ion traps, optical lattices, but that may change, so I wouldn't know. There's no obvious winner at this point.
Some people think it already exists. Dave Finkelstein thinks the universe is a giant quantum.
Well, that was, you know, Spinoza thought that the whole universe is just God, right?
And from Spinoza, we go to the general audience. now's our opportunity to allow all of you, or at least some of you, to ask various questions. There's a question from the gentleman right here in the white shirt. Oh, that was part of my question earlier, I think, but maybe I didn't express it quite as well. But perhaps that's it. That's a more. So let me reiterate your question as I understand it. This idea of unification, where did it come from historically? And I asked a question earlier as to the merits of it and recognizing that Einstein was doing it, but I think your question is related more to a historical question. So I will ask the historian among us to my right.
You're not gonna
give a PowerPoint.
I've never had been historian.
Well, you are the historian at the table. So.
Historically, I got into physics through German natural philosophy, and Humboldt cosmos is an example of that. The idea that all forces of nature should somehow be unified, because that's the nature of the universe. As Howard says, it really goes back to Spinoza in one way, but it got its physics through German natural philosophy. And then the striking success of Maxwell's theory at the end of the 19th century impressed so many people. It's such disparate phenomena as electricity, magnetism, and optics, which seem to have nothing to do with it. These can be united. Well, why should we stop here? It's a very strong motivation for physicists.
I do think that's certainly true, but I think one could argue that unification, depending on how you define unification, goes back even further. I mean, you could go back to the ancient Greeks, and you could look at the motivation that people, even pre-Platonic, like Pythagoras, had when he had his world view about how the world was inherently mathematical and how the world was all number. That could be interpreted, I would speculate, as a form of unification, although rather different. Well, sure. Depends on how you define physics. Okay. Did you want to...
Not really. I just wanted to... I'm not quite a specialist in this field, I have to say, but it is, I was reading an interesting book, I think it was by Paul Davies, I don't remember exactly the title, where he was arguing that the reason why we believe and sort of the modern science actually in unification, the modern science evolved in a Western society is because of religion. Now, it's a very difficult and shaky topic, so I have to be careful here, but basically his view was that a monotheistic religion like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam actually promotes the view of a God the Creator that set down the rules. So physicists or scientists can say, oh, okay, there are rules to be discovered, and therefore there is a set of rules, and therefore let's try to go on and discover them. Interestingly enough, in some in Buddhism or in some other cultures in Far East, that is not always the case. So there's not necessarily a concept of a set of rules that are unified and so on and so forth. But again, I have to say that probably I'm quite ignorant actually on this topic, so don't ask me any further penetrating questions on this. But it may perhaps someone in the audience, as I could see that you raised the hands.
Well, there's also Zoroastrianism, which has dualism, light and dark, good and evil. So I suppose with Zoroastrianism, at times, you look for two forces, for two contenders.
So I think it's time to move on, but I do want to just add as a parenthetic comment, it is interesting psychologically when I look at Arthur to recognize that when it comes to what he considers a personal issue, he is reasonably forthcoming, although he adds a disclaimer with regards to issues of religion and spirituality. However, he's extremely reticent to talk about his interpretation of quantum theory. Gentleman right
there. Do any of you have any views on the theory that the laws of physics might actually be evolving as opposed to being immutable?
Gary, why don't you take that one?
I think most physicists view the laws of physics as immutable in the sense that they're not changing sort of continuously in time. If the laws change continuously in time, we would have no hope of discovering them because what we look for are regularities, things that we can test by repeated measurements. And if the laws changed, you know, daily or something, we would, you know, not have any physics. So at least, you know, in our epoch of the universe, the laws are, we believe, fixed. Now, some people speculate that, you know, if the Big Bang was really a big bounce and there was some earlier phase of the universe, perhaps the laws looked a little different in that phase, or maybe the laws would be the same as in the general form, but the values of certain fundamental constants might have been different. I mean, these are the things people talk about, and maybe that gets shuffled when you go through the Big Bang and stuff. That we can't say, but at least in sort of some continuously changing way, I think most people don't think that that could be the case.
Another possible answer to your question is that, you know, if the laws are changing, there must be a law about the changing of the law, which they may not be changing, right?
Well, Einstein was upset about probabilistic interpretation of quantum mechanics. He said, if there's probability in the universe, he could believe more easily in a totally random universe than he could in a universe which there are laws of probability. So that's another problem to think about. Could one have a totally random universe? Could we exist in a totally random universe? Or somehow our existence somehow tied up with the nature of the fact that there's some sort of law-like structure in our universe? I mean, in the universe we live in.
The volunteer, gentleman with the white shirt.
My question was, for superstring theory, strings are supposedly one-dimensional. What dimension is that? Like, is it just purely length or purely being? Like, how can we speak of something as one dimension?
The one dimension that we speak of is length. It's length. In fact, strings always exist in time. So when I say it's one-dimensional, I mean sort of at any moment of time, it's a one-dimensional loop, just so it has a length. But like everything, it will exist in time. So if you ask what does it look like in a complete space-time picture, it's two-dimensional. A point on, you know, on the sort of world sheet, as we say, of the string requires two numbers, the time that you're talking about and where along the string you're talking about. So it would be two-dimensional.
We have time for one or two more questions, and then I'm going to ask all of our panelists a question to sum up. So, you've had your turn. Len's had his turn before. The woman right in front of me here. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering now, as things are changing and evolving, should it also be a way that we perceive things from the perspective of our minds, changing or evolving?
So I'm going to direct that question to John, but before I do, I'm just going to make a parenthetical comment. You mentioned brilliant people experimenting with things, and I would respectfully disagree with that. Most experimenters I know, with one notable exception in this room, are not brilliant. it's the theorists who are brilliant, except for Monsieur Laflamme over there, who of course can uniquely combine theory and experiment in such a brilliant manner. John.
Of course, one of the ways which we try to handle change, in particular in physics, is finding something that remains constant during the change. We look for conservation laws. So this interplay between constancy and change always goes on. In fact, the concept of energy was developed because of this. It seemed like there was a situation in which mechanical energy disappeared, but now we want to believe that it's conserved, so then we have to show that every process involves some different form of energy, chemical energy, nuclear energy, so on, and it's all really conserved. The neutrino was invented by Pauli to preserve the principle of conservation of energy at a time when his reputable physicist Bohr was doubting whether the conservation of energy was more than a statistical law. So this is one of the ways we handle change, is to say that there is something that remains constant while these changes are going on. That gives us, I guess, a feeling of security, too. Psychologically, yes, I think we of course, are always changing, and that's what gives us hope, because our knowledge is certainly fallible, but it's corrigible. That's the great thing about scientific knowledge, that although we always must be ready to question any scientific statement, it could always be wrong. Who was, I think it was Cromwell, said, "I beseech you by the bowels of Christ, consider it. You may be wrong." And so too often we forget that. But in, at least the scientific approach says we should be ready to question anything, even if each individual isn't so ready. But then the point is we have a method for correcting our knowledge, and that's what gives us the hope for it to go on. There's this metaphor which goes back to the Greeks, and Otto Neurath reintroduced it into modern philosophy. We're like people sailing on a ship at sea, and we can't put into dry dock to correct any failures that develop in the ship, any flaws that the ship has. We have to continue to sail the ship while we're repairing it. And that's a wonderful image, I think, for scientific quest, and what makes it so wonderful, so perilous, and so inspiring for me, anyway.
And we will sail out to one more question from the gentleman well back there at the end of the bar. So let me start with John, and then Archer, and then Gary.
Well, it's quite true that his greatest progress was made because he had some sort of handle on some realistic phenomena. For example, the special relativity came out of the fact that he had to deal with the nature of light. How can you make the existence of the light phenomena consistent with the relativity principle of mechanics? And they had showed you could do that if you invent a new kinematics. The general theory of relativity came out of the equivalence principle, the idea that inertia and gravitation cannot be told apart because of the fact that inertial mass and gravitational mass are equal, measured in the same unit. And out of this, thinking about that from so many years, came the general theory of relativity. With the unified field theory, he had nothing really beyond a heuristic idea. Somehow, gravitation and electromagnetism should be unified. Why? Well, just the quest for unity. And he, therefore, was looking for the simplest mathematical equations which could embody this idea, and I think that's probably what Feynman had in mind. He became more and more relying on mathematics. He had no intuitive physical concept to inspire him, and that's, I think, ultimately why the quest failed.
It's actually an interesting question. It seems to me that we do physics in somewhat two different ways. Some people are driven by intuition and have some insights, and some people are guided through by mathematical equations, so you can just do mathematics step by step and start discovering things. And it seems to me that a real breakthrough happens on the path where you're just guided by intuition, you just make conjectures, you jump into conclusions. However, having said this, of course, there's lots of good physics discovered step by step by good mathematics and good tools. So both rules are valid, but I tend to believe that it's probably you achieve much more if you're not afraid to just follow your intuition, jump into conclusion, let mathematics be sorted out later on.
Gary?
Yeah, I have to agree very much with that. I think that the major qualitative leaps in progress that we see in physics almost always come from this intuitive leap. You suddenly see a connection between two things that hadn't been appreciated before. And rarely do you sort of do a long detailed calculation and end up with sort of a qualitative, you know, new insight into something.
Very good.
John Newton, for example, had this intuition that what makes the apple fall to the ground should be the same thing that makes the moon revolve around the Earth. But he had the wrong date originally, and he didn't publish for years because he couldn't make the mathematical agreement. So the intuition was there, but of course the next step, you have to make that mathematical step, make it agree. Until you do that, you've got to bring an idea, not a theory.
The math is the queen of scientists, but
it's the tool, it's the servant, it's the servant.
So, well, just hold on, because I think we're running to the end of our time. I'd like to, again, this is the Legacy Weekend, and this is the last series of questions from Bistro Banter for the Legacy Weekend. And so I'd like to ask each one of our panelists a separate question. That's all to their own, with no interruptions. And I will start with you, John. And again, let's look back at Einstein. And here we are. We're envisioning this this iconic figure of Albert Einstein, who we've learned so much about over the past 3 weeks. And were he alive today, what would he make of the current state of theoretical physics, John? And what would he be doing, in your view?
He would probably say, oh, man. But I think one thing, he would have to revise his views about quantum entanglement, because his point of view, he was so much, his vision so much concentrated on space-time concepts. The idea that two regions of space-time should have some sort of interaction between them, which was not a causal interaction, was for him very counterintuitive, which is really his great objection to quantum entanglement. Not so much the probability as what we now call the entanglement. But I think since the experiments that have been done, since Bell's theorem and the experiments of Aspect and Clauser and Shimoni, he would have to revise that. It would be very interesting to see how he would do it, but I think he would have to do that. But I think his fundamental insight, and here again I come back to Poincaré's other, that general relativity represents a qualitative new step in giving us a background independent physics. I personally think the future lies in that direction, and how that will be come about, I think he could perhaps make a great contribution to that work alive today.
So, Gary, now I turn to you and ask a similar sort of question that's perhaps a little bit more focused. As you mentioned in your talk, the superstring theory is certainly the most dominant, most popular form of approach towards the quantum theory of gravity and towards unification simultaneously. Einstein was certainly concerned about both of these issues. He was concerned, of course, about foundations of quantum theory, and he was concerned about unification of quantum theory and general theory of relativity, and he was concerned about a general spirit of unification. So were he alive today, what would he make of superstring theory, in your view? And what would be his concerns, and what would give him satisfaction from the program?
Well, as you say, I think he would be very interested and excited by the unification ideas and the quantum gravity ideas. Of course, it's hard to say, but as John alluded to earlier in this discussion session, there is another approach to quantum gravity, which starts off at least more focused on general relativity. And he, because of his history in the subject, he might be more naturally attracted to that approach to quantum gravity to start with, because it's more closely tied to general relativity right from the start. I think, well, it remains to be seen how things turn out. I think that he might have been won over to string theory eventually.
And Arthur, let me turn to you. We've talked about and under some duress, you've been forthcoming with views on foundations of quantum theory. We've talked about Einstein's difficulties. You so interestingly mentioned in your talk that people seem less concerned, and of course I concur, people seem less concerned with foundations of quantum theory now than they had 30 or 40 or 50 or 60, perhaps more relevantly, years ago. And it wasn't clear to you whether or not they had just accepted it or whether they understood it any better or whether they just thought they understood it any better. If Einstein were alive today, would he still be as preoccupied as he was previously with foundational issues of quantum theory? Or, as John has alluded to, would the events of the past 40 or 50 years have given him some consolation, had given him some pause, would change his views and his troubles with quantum mechanics? Let me just stop there.
Well, it's difficult to say, really, honestly. It's a pity that Einstein didn't live long enough to see Bell's inequalities and what followed later on. I would like to say that, of course, he would be very much into the Everett view and we'll just forget about all difficulties and we'll work on quantum computing, of course. But I don't know. The point is that to see quantum mechanics as embedded into the classical world, that was how Einstein perceived that. That's why we saw so many paradoxes coming out of that. On the border between quantum and classical, things happen. And I wonder whether he would then extend his view and say, well, maybe there is not such a border. Maybe the whole thing is just quantum. And then it would be interesting to see what kind of conclusion would he draw from that. But let me stop here. I don't think I can say much more.
Thank you very much. And let us all stop here.
I'd like to say one final word.
This does not surprise me unduly.
I think what would worry Einstein most today is the fate of our country. As early as 1947, he wrote an essay on what he called the military mentality.
This is the fate of your country, you mean?
Our country, the United States.
No, your country.
I apologize. I forgot where I was. Well, we need it a lot more in my country than in yours. He wrote this essay on the military mentality, and he pointed out how the United States, as early as that, 2 years into the Cold War, was following the path of not Hitler's Germany, but Bismarck's Germany, the path of looking for a military solution to all problems. And he warned that this was going to lead us into preventive wars, abrogation of civil rights of the American people, government trampling on information, freedom of information, and trying to manipulate information. He predicted all of this word for word in 1947. I think he would be extremely alarmed to see how much truth his prophecies were being realized, unfortunately, 60 years later. I wish I could say Einstein's political views or history. They're not. They're very important for us today to take to heart his warnings. And I think that would be the issue that would concern a lot more than quantum mechanics or general relativity, I must say.
Thank you. And with those sobering... With those sobering, comprehensive, if unsolicited words, I think that that's important because, as we all know, we've been spending the last 3 weeks not just talking about Einstein's physics, but talking about Einstein the man, talking about Einstein the legacy, and talking about the times in which he lived and all the factors that affected him and in turn affect us. And so I think it's extremely relevant. If unsolicited, but John did mention this again. And at this time, I would like to thank very, very warmly all of our panelists for participating in this last American Express Bistro Banter. Thank you all very, very much. And thank all of you. Please feel free to stay and eat and drink and be merry to your heart's content. It was very nice to see you all, and we do look forward to seeing you next year during a festival to be named later.